Oh no, I didn't mean to close the breakout rooms.
You're just gonna have to visit with us then.
I just hit the button, I guess.
Did. We were surprised. It was short, but that's okay. Our conversation had lagged.
Come on, the party was just getting started.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Yeah, I just accidentally hit the button to close the breakout room, so I didn't mean to call you all back. Oh, well, nobody seems heartbroken. All right.
We're quite obedient.
All right, well.
Demi, I have to ask, I saw you wearing the head cover. Is that just to keep warm, or is that?
Yeah, it's just to keep warm. I'm out here in it's essentially a tough shed. I call it my studio, and it's insulated, but I'm finding it's actually toasty in here, but I don't know about other folks, but I'm finding it a little challenge to get used to the cold. So, yeah, I wear a hat most of the day.
Okay.
Oh, all right. Well, kind of an intimate little group tonight. Go around and say hello. Starting with Marv and Shoketsu, Tyler, Franklin, Bob K, Drew, Jinryu, Shane, John, Sam, Karen, Susan, Joan, Jill, and Gethel. All right. Thanks for having your daughter's visit, Jill. That was a great highlight of my day.
How long did they meditate?
They didn't. They sat through the chant, and then they were like, but I like how they do this, like, I don't know where they get that from, but they do that and then close their eyes and then. I'm glad that they're interested.
I'm just amazed that, like, you watch the screen and it's just like, here they are. You look back a second later. There they are. Look back a second later. There they are. It's like,
very calming.
Oh, if only I had that much energy. All right. Let's see. Oh, let me get my water. So let's see. Invite you to register for Rohatsu. It's not necessary to register. But, you know, it's nice to know that we're going to have some people participating. That's our early December retreat that will be online. I can't think of, oh yeah, members meeting. Is that this Sunday? Okay. So, this Sunday, in place of Dharma Talk, we will, so that's at 11:15, we will have our annual members meeting, and but anybody is welcome to come. Members are encouraged to come, but you don't have to be a formal member to participate, and it's basically a report from me and from the board, and primarily from the board, just about the status of our Zen Center and financially, legally, plans for the future, volunteers, that kind of thing. So please take the time to come and see another aspect of the Zen Center. Anything else anybody can think of that we should we should announce. All right. We'll start early. Maybe we'll just end early. Yeah, Karen.
I just noticed this is being recorded. Is that on mm-hmm. purpose?
Yeah, we usually record the classes.
I didn't notice that before. And is it posted on the website or what do you do with it?
It is. So after a few days, giving Bob time to kind of edit it up a little bit and post it, it appears on the website under resources, audio, and then it's separated into Dharma Talks and classes. And there's also links to the recordings in the newsletter.
Yeah, we've updated that to recordings because we have video and audio.
Ah, yes, yes. They're just recordings of various kinds. No more.
And it goes back many months, years. So we've got lots to choose from if you so desire.
And thank you very much, Bob, for doing that for us. Okay. So tonight, we're continuing with Norman Fisher's book, The World Could Be Otherwise. And we're starting on chapter 3, The Perfection of Ethical Conduct. So I'm imagining most folks here know about the definition of bodhisattva, but just in case, a bodhisattva is ideal in Buddhism, if you will, of a being who practices diligently, achieves liberation, enlightenment, whatever you want to call it, but not just for their own sake, not just so that they can be relieved from suffering and kind of in Buddhist cosmology, never be reborn again, just kind of check out. The bodhisattva vows to be reborn over and over, to stay in this world until all beings are freed. And it's that recognition at a deep level that my liberation is not separate from yours. There's no way that I can truly, you know, be liberated and be at peace while others are suffering, for instance. So the bodhisattva takes, we have our bodhisattva vows that we recite. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. And the understanding is all of them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them all. And the Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. So these are, it's a grand aspiration. But in Mahayana Buddhism, we teach that everyone is on the bodhisattva path. So it's not like, you know, you just opt to do something else. You're not up for the bodhisattva path. That's only for the special people over there, that we're all on the bodhisattva path. So page 55, Fisher talks about this and says, we are regular people doing regular things. Who could deny it? But also, we are heroic bodhisattvas. This doesn't make us different from anyone else. Everyone is a bodhisattva. Everyone has imagination and an infinite wish for the happiness and welfare of all beings, however much they may be out of touch with this aspiration. Being a bodhisattva is just being human. But as intentional bodhisattvas, we are trying to remember this side of our humanity more often and live it as best we can. So, I just wanted to kind of open this up for discussion for a moment. We're all heroic bodhisattvas. Are you a heroic bodhisattva? Can you see every person you know as a heroic bodhisattva? I just thought that was a very kind of a provocative statement. Heroic, too. A heroic bodhisattva. Do you believe this? In what sense is it true? And just go ahead and unmute yourself if you have something to say.
I believe it. And because, you know, I think just believing that brings me to have compassion for myself and to everyone else. So to just to believe that I am doing the best that I can with all of my, you know, faults and things I'm trying to improve or overcome. And so if I do that, I can have compassion for myself and then believe that of everyone else, that they're doing the best they can. I think that's heroic. I think that's what that's the thought that comes up for me. So
I think I'd have to buy into the whole transmigration business. I think for some people, it seems like that ship may have sailed in this lifetime. If there are future lifetimes, certainly it seems, you know, that seems plausible.
I think the line that, like, no, however much they may be out of touch with this aspiration is kind of, I guess, what makes me willing to accept that. I think about, like, when we're working with kids at the play school, when, like, a child is, say, hitting another child, we try to not look at the behavior, but look at the stresses that child is facing in those moments. So what stresses are causing them to not, you know, the child doesn't want to hurt anyone else. They don't want to. They're stressed out, and their reaction might be a stress reaction of hitting. And we say it so that you're not looking at the actions of the child, but the thing causing them to act in such a way. And so I think that there might be people that are deep down want, I believe with their heart, want wellness for everyone, but maybe there's just things going on in their life that they just can't. They're not aspiring to that at the moment, I guess. Because there are other things that are just taking over them at the time. I think in their heart, that's what most people want.
When I think about people who, you know, act selfishly, destructively, immorally, like, what is it? What is it within them that is manifests in any way? What, you know, how is that heroic bodhisattvahood manifesting even when people are out of touch with it, not acting it out?
Is it manifestation or potential?
Well, I think the seems like the implication of the Mahayana teachings is that you have Buddha nature. Not you will someday if you work on it really hard, but you have Buddha nature. Even if you're not, and if you're not manifesting it.
I guess what I meant is is you always have it, but the potential to express it.
Mm. And what about being a bodhisattva is just being human? This kind of makes it sound to me like the altruism, the aspiration, the selflessness and generosity of a bodhisattva is somehow built into us. Somehow built into the human makeup. Do you resonate with that idea? Or no?
Well, it was like last week when we were talking about generosity, I kind of get a glimmer of it. It sort of felt like, I could see that in myself and know that there are times when I'm feeling, the more strong or sort of authentic, there are times when you feel more authentically yourself. You just feel like you're more able to deal with everything and be a larger presence. And so when we were talking about an actual thing like generosity, I could see that more than just with ethics,
Well, I just read this book called Humankind, which I would recommend it. It's thick, but it goes fast. It's full of anecdotal stories. This guy studied people all over the world and studies that have been done. And some studies showed that people didn't treat the people nice when they were set up to. But when he dug into the studies, people were basically good. So he goes through this whole book trying to prove that people are basically good and want to do the right thing and help others. And I think most people do. I think there's a little population of sociopaths that maybe don't, but people are good.
Yeah, if you look at, there's not very many remaining. There are still some simple hunter-gatherer cultures around. And unless there is a shortage of something, they generally are peaceful. And sometimes extremely peaceful and happy. I think that that's our base nature. When you start wanting something is when I think conflicts happen. Because if you look at some of the Indians and the South American jungles called the fierce people, the Yanomoto, they're very violent, but because of their blood type group, they have a shortage of women and they fight for women. Mm. So, but the Kong Bushmen are very peaceful people. They don't have a lot, they don't want a lot. In fact, that whole, if you remember The Gods Must Be Crazy, remember that movie? Or he finds a Coke bottle and they all start worshiping it. Eventually he takes it and throws it off the edge of the world. That's kind of the Kung. So yeah, I think at the very basic level, with exceptions for people who are chemically imbalanced one way or the other, our Buddha nature shows, and that's related to being a bodhisattva.
But it's interesting to me that he follows that sentence about we're just ordinary people. We bodhisattvas are just ordinary people, or whatever that sentence is. We're just being human. But he follows it with, but as intentional bodhisattvas, we are trying to remember this side of our humanity more often and live it as best we can. And I kind of have the feeling about myself that my intention is good in some moments and maybe not so good in others, and it has to do with really like my connection with the ineffable, whether it's out there or in here, and how well I'm doing at cultivating that. And so it's kind of like I'm not always on. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes I'm a little bit away from the energy. And I may come across as being not as intentional.
I think it's very, it's one of my favorite things about Buddhism, that, you know, its view of human nature is quite optimistic. At least in the Mahayana, in the, you know, earlier Buddhism, it's kind of like, it was a little bit more like a tabula rasa, like we could go either way. It's up to you. Do this, do that, you know, I mean, you can choose your way. So, I mean, that's optimistic in a way. It doesn't say we're by nature selfish and bad, although it does say we have those, like, the forces of greed, hate, and delusion arise, but so do other impulses. So, but it definitely, in the Mahayana, we have a sense that, kind of like, can't remember who was saying, but just like, unless our nature gets perverted through, you know, bad experiences, bad treatment, you know, trauma, whatever, we kind of start off pretty open. And certainly empathetic and concerned about other beings. So that's like just getting in touch with our true nature is, I like that. And also it gives me a way to deal with, mentally and emotionally deal with people who are not acting ethically, people who are acting selfishly and destructively, because I guess I understand they're not getting away with something. They're enacting sadness and a sense of separation, and that the effects of those actions on them aren't good. They're not really getting away with anything, even if it kind of technically they might be. So that leads me to the next part, which is the idea, similarly in Mahayana Buddhism, where we view enlightened behavior, so following all the ethical precepts that were mentioned in this chapter and other forms of ethics, we say it's describing the behavior of a Buddha. So if you were completely awakened, completely liberated from self-concern, this is how you would act. So at the beginning, it's kind of a fake it till you make it thing, right? At the beginning, we may need to, as Fisher was talking about, like restrain ourselves and train ourselves and kind of work hard in order to act according to these ethical guidelines. But over time, it should get easier. Over time, it becomes something more sincere, coming straight from our heart. And so that ultimately the idea is that the Bodhisattva or Buddha they're not just, you know, rule bound, going around following a bunch of rules. They are acting spontaneously. They are acting just straight out of their heart. This just happens to be how they look, how it looks. So Fisher says, on page 55, the six perfections are empty, which is what makes them perfections. Just as we are ordinary people and at the same time beyond that, so the six perfections are beyond themselves. So the Bodhisattva's perfection of ethical conduct isn't the usual sort of ethical conduct. It's ethical conduct beyond ethical conduct. It's both the entry gate to the path and the path's ultimate fruition. At first, it involves some intentional restraint, but as bodhisattvas continue on the path, they easily and spontaneously practice it without particularly noticing. At this point, the perfection of ethical conduct isn't uptight or restrictive. It's a joyful path of doing what comes naturally out of the fullness of the heart. So he goes on to talk about how meditation and our practice sensitizes us to the feelings and experiences of others, to our own experiences, sensitizes us and helps us pay attention to the results of our actions so that we start to really notice where we might have just been acting out of habit and done something and been causing some harm. But with practice, with meditation, we start to see that more. And therefore, that can provide a feedback, some feedback that can change our behavior as well. So I think, I'm not sure if everybody here is familiar with the precepts. I really liked Fisher's version of the precepts. It's of course the three refuges. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. Then the three pure precepts are, I vow to refrain from harmful conduct, I vow to cultivate beneficial conduct, I vow to benefit all beings. And then the grave precepts, or the clear mind precepts, I vow to protect life, not to kill. So he puts the positive first. I vow to receive gifts, not to steal. I vow to respect others, not to misuse sexuality. I vow to be truthful, not to lie. I vow to remain clear, not to intoxicate self or others. I vow to speak kindly, to not speak ill of others. I vow to practice modesty, not to praise self at the expense of others. I vow to practice generosity, not to be possessive of anything. I vow to practice loving kindness, not to harbor ill will. I vow to cherish and polish the three treasures. I really liked those. So I was wondering whether folks here who have been practicing with the precepts for a while might have a story to share about your relationship to any particular precept with which you've had a changing relationship over time. So I think of this as being converted to the precepts one by one. So through this process where at first, right, maybe we read these or we become a Buddhist or something and we think, okay, well, this is a pretty decent list of ethical code of conduct suggestions. I'll agree. But at first it might just be, for some of them anyway, just kind of a rote thing that you do. But over time, with this greater sensitivity, with meditation and mindfulness and paying attention, getting to the point where you really don't want to break that precept anymore. Like if you have sufficient mindfulness and presence of mind, I mean, sometimes we get carried away and habit energy takes over. But if we have sufficient presence of mind, we don't even want to break the precept. So I don't know if anybody has any experiences with the precepts like that. there any precepts that you just like somebody might even coax you to break, but you'd say no thanks?
I'm newer, so I didn't want to jump in, but about a year and a half ago, I got put on some medication for my rheumatoid arthritis, which meant I couldn't drink. And so the choice to stop drinking at that moment was not my choice, but I was willing to accept it. And it started happening, and I noticed it really changed when I went through actually the holiday season with my in-laws and my family and stuff like that, and not drinking. It made me really realize, even though like I don't have like a problem with drinking, I'm still functional, but how much I was relying on that to get through certain events and like, or enjoy myself in the evening or whatever it was, how much I was attaching, and how the longer I stopped and wasn't on it, I was, you know, the doctor's like, oh, well, you can have some here or there. It's fine now, right? Like, we've seen the medication is fine if you want to have a drink a couple times or a week, once a week. And I was like, I don't. It's been a year and I do not want to do it. And I've been in a few situations where like, it's a celebration, like have one. And a couple times I've been like, okay, sure. And I've done it. And I'm like, oh, I was really unhappy that I went back on that. And even this, it's really funny. And I've never had a say that big feelings about drinking one way or another, but I was shocked at how much I learned about myself over that time, to the point where I just don't really want to anymore. And that was a really big change for me.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, I also, I vow to remain clear, and intoxicants was kind of a way of life for a long time for me, and I don't do that anymore. But I've also expanded my definition of intoxicants, so I can't say that I'm completely clear. And so reading this chapter was good for me because it reminded me that there are lots of things that can be intoxicants that we don't necessarily think of as intoxicants. And you know, whether it's behaviors or substances or almost anything, I think. So it's got me focused on the more positive side, which is the clarity that he talks about. And I think more than just the clarity, it's also the willingness to, you know, the term that you've been using, to bear witness, the willingness to bear witness to my own suffering, that's huge, right? So all that's related, I think, to this idea of clarity and avoiding intoxicants.
Thank you.
I really appreciate what I've heard about this, and I'm thinking of a different precept, which I mentioned the other Sunday, and that was, how does he say it? I vow to speak kindly, not to speak ill of others. Once again, I like the old-fashioned way of saying it. Which is the way Robert Aiken says it, which is not dwelling on past mistakes. Creating wisdom from ignorance. I would definitely say I am at the point where when I break this precept, I am very uncomfortable. And the times when I break the precept are when I can't figure out what happened. Was this woman that much of a bitch? I mean, come on. I mean, you know, it's a little extreme, but you know what I'm saying. And as others have shared about vowing for clarity and maintaining clarity, and being sensitive to that, I have become very sensitive to what it sounds like and feels like when someone judges me. And that's about all I can say. But what I will say, one last thing, and that is that when I think this through, and that might be true of others who are working on a particular precept, when I really think this through beyond the moment that I'm in right now, where I am so hurt or confused or angered or whatever, I can really have compassion for the other person. You know, what kind of a person has a hole that large to where they say things like that, or they do things like that, or, you know, what is it about them that they feel like I have to fix in this way by hurting others or by being a certain way at a certain point in time? And the other thing I have to remember, which this the fifth precept really helps me with, is we're talking about a point in time. We're not talking about forever when someone behaves a certain way or judges me or whatever. They only did it for a moment. And, you know, unless somebody, they only did it for a moment, and it's not up to me to declare them forever lost. If you know what I mean.
Thank you.
With regard to the first precept, don't can get through most days without even wanting to like commit homicide. It's not a difficult one to keep on a literal level, but I've been just from various teachers in the Zen tradition and Theravada tradition on this one, they sort of redefine it and in terms of not wanting to eliminate certain things from your experience, certain unpleasant things from your experience, whether that's people or your own pain or your own suffering. And that's sort of a less literal interpretation of non-killing. Mm-hmm. But just what we were talking about on Sunday right now is that it's, you know, it's really easy to want to eliminate Trumpism from our individual and collective psyches, but it's sort of here, and we need to understand it and the forms of greed that underlie it and everything. So not eliminating that, but instead trying to understand it. And similarly, like with my own suffering, you know, not trying to eliminate that. I feel like that makes me better able to just to listen to people when they're going through something difficult, and just to openly listen without, you know, without giving into that twinge of discomfort that might often feel at the beginning of that conversation. So.
Thank you. Yeah. For myself, I know I don't say that I keep the kind speech precept perfectly by any means, but I used to be a lot worse. Particularly, you know, you get together with friends or family and you bitch about people and you bitch about someone and you just, you know, you feed off each other and you're just like, oh, why is that whatever? And I began, you know, through that sensitivity, and we talk about this process, because like he talks about this restraint and then cultivating good and then doing good for others. And so we talk about it as, you know, first you kind of just try to stop the energy that is leading you down the habit. And it's difficult. You know, a lot of times you only catch it afterwards, and then you catch it right afterwards, and then you catch it kind of as you're doing it, but you can't stop it. And then you kind of catch it early on, but you still can't stop it. And then you catch it earlier, and maybe you could, you know, change things a little bit. So I began to recognize, as I was getting caught up in these kinds of conversations, I wouldn't necessarily stop, but there was part of me, like, I felt like, you know, I was eating a White Castle hamburger or something, and I knew I was going to feel bad later, like kind of physically, like really bad, just like, I knew later on I would just, okay, I'm indulging in this right now, but it's later I'm going to regret this. So that was a very interesting thing to notice. It wasn't this external, like, you shouldn't do this, it would be a bad person. But just if I paid attention, I realized, like, I actually don't want to indulge in that kind of bad mouthing others or whatever. So I feel like for me, it has been like, I would say there might even be a couple precepts left that I'm not entirely converted to in that way. You know, that I think maybe do not indulge anger might be one of them. Or I'm still kind of like, well, I still kind of like getting mad, you know. I don't have quite that same clarity of connection between the breakage of the precept and a negative consequence. But I know it's gonna come. I know it'll come. Any other tales, struggles with precepts, and coming to believe in one?
Yomio, could I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Maybe this is too big of a question, but I was just wondering, maybe just some Zen history on why is generosity not part of the precepts? Why is that separate from the other ethical precepts?
Well, I mean, we consider the, what do you mean? So we have the practice generosity, do not be possessive of anything. Or in our phrasing, we do it, do not be mean with dharma or wealth. You're muted.
I guess I got confused since it's a separate chapter in the book. So that answers my question, I guess.
Well, and here's the thing, is Buddhism has countless lists. So it's got the precepts and it's got the perfections. So the six perfections, right? And like, I liked my teacher Kyogen talked about it as the Dharma is like a tomato. You can slice it a lot of different ways. So you could, you know, slice it as the perfections, but then you slice it as the precepts, and there's kind of overlap. It's not like they're all, so it's more like a fractal in a way. Like you have the Four Noble Truths. The fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. So like, yeah.
I see. Just different lists overlapping.
Yeah, and different ways to approach the practice. So, you know, we do a lot of precept work, and so the practice of generosity tends to come in within that precept of do not be mean with dharma or wealth. But I do kind of like, I think there's a value to approaching it through the lens of the paramita, which is, it's not just about kind of don't be stingy. It has more of a positive quality, exploring this generosity as a perfection.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to discuss another provocative passage, and I'm going to read it and then put us into breakouts to reflect on it. And in a very open way, I don't have any particular question to focus you, but I just want folks to just talk. What do you think of this? What does it bring up for you? So this is at the bottom of page 58. To take refuge in the three treasures is to confirm as one's primary motivation the bodhisattva commitment to working toward goodness and depth in living. For bodhisattvas, it isn't enough to get what you need and desire, to protect yourself or your family, to accumulate wealth, security, and reputation. It's not that bodhisattvas are against any of that. They too recognize these goals and desires as natural. It's just that bodhisattvas are committed to a much more ambitious goal, a greater obligation, a higher and wider calling. They want much more joy, much more love, much more justice and well-being for themselves and for everyone. Personal well-being is only a means to this end. So, would you, I want to make sure that each breakout group has a book. So, would you raise your hand if you have a book? I can see Shoketsu has a book, Franklin. So, I should write down who doesn't have a book. Susan, Sam. Oh, Shane has it. Okay. All right, cool. Let me, all right. All right. I don't know what your guys' conversations were like, but somebody in our group said, what's provocative about that?
Well, I was going to ask you, if I may, why did you make that the center of the conversation in a breakout?
I guess I didn't want to influence people's discussions too much by like prefacing what I thought about it, but I guess for bodhisattvas, it isn't enough to get what you need and desire, to protect yourself and your family. Those things are fine. We want much more. Personal well-being is only a means to this end. Personal well-being is only a means to benefiting others. And I, when I reflect on the people that I know, when I reflect on myself, I don't know that I know too many people for whom personal well-being is only a means to an end. I think, and I don't think we beat ourselves up about need to beat ourselves up about that, right? This is an ongoing practice, but I think for most of us, our personal well-being is pretty central. It's pretty like the main focus of our lives. It's like, what am I going to get out of my life? What do I enjoy? What do I want to do next? What kind of experiences do I want to have? What kind of relationships do I want to have? I mean, you know, you only live once, you gotta enjoy it, right? So I guess I just find that a little, yeah. What were some other thoughts on that?
I heard a podcast recently, I think it was Zen Mountain something something. Anyway, they guy was talking about the realization of how self absorbed we are, and that usually comes at some point in your meditation practice. And then most people are shocked to realize that like 90% of their thoughts, if not more, are about themselves, you know. So I'm not sure how this exactly ties into what you're talking about, but if I feel like it does, so I'll just leave it there. But I think that's a really good point. And I think probably a bodhisattva or someone that's further along the path than I am is probably spending significantly less time thinking just about their position in the world, whatever that position is. So thanks.
And this ties into an aspect of my crisis Buddhism formulation, you know, the bearing witness taking care and taking action, but I had that's like the two kind of guiding principles were always be motivated by love or goodwill. And the second being to expand your sphere of concern as wide as possible. So one of the things that came up in our group is like, you know, there are plenty of people that they're looking out for themselves and they think of themselves as being very generous because they also perhaps look out for their family or maybe their friends or maybe their immediate community or, you know, maybe people of the same race or religion or whatever. But there's a boundary. and the Bodhisattva's practice is expanding that boundary. Like, so in a way, like that can be a lifelong practice, right? Is trying to always expand that boundary. And I think for myself, I think of, again, our practice is about ourselves and not about judging others. But I do look out in the world and I see people acting and voting in ways that do not show consideration for others. If it's not about me, if I'm getting what I need, then screw all the people, screw all those other people who my actions or my vote or my decisions, my way of living are seriously impacting. So frankly, I think this is kind of like, this is the Buddhist equivalent of, you know, Christ saying, like, whatever you do to the least of my brothers, that you do unto me. You know, it's like saying, you know, this ideal, which is very lofty, is that our personal well-being is just a means to an end. Just a means to bring joy and greater justice and whatever we can do in the world.
When I first heard you talk about that last sentence, it sounded to me like maybe you were being, it sounded cynical. And I simply didn't look at that sentence that way. What came to my mind immediately is when you're on the airplane and they tell you, if you're with a little child, you put the mask on yourself first and then you help the little kid because you got to take care of yourself first. And isn't that what my practice and my meditation are doing? Is taking care of me so that I can be more useful in a broader world?
I mean, we can only answer that for ourselves. And I would say our practice is taking care of ourselves. I just think we all have room to grow. I do a whole lot more of taking care. Like, it's not just a means to an end, you know.
I use that exact same description in my group of the oxygen in the plane, and it was before Domio had kind of explained why she thought this was a project thing, and then she said that, and I was like, right, because like that's true, like my practice is so I can be better forever. But like, is the reason why I accumulate wealth to take care of my immediate family, and then I've got a bit more wealth than I need to take care of my immediate family, I'm not then just like using that directly to help further people out. I'm like, oh, I can go to Tofino and go surfing, right? Like that's my purpose for my accumulating wealth now, is that I can take a little trip with my family, and totally unnecessarily I could surf near my or whatever. But like it was right. It's like, right. Okay. It's like, maybe if that's like, it's not just a means to an end to help other people. There are other things that I do for me. And so once she re-clarified what she thought about it, I was like, right. Okay. There's a lot more to this than this paragraph than I was initially seeing.
And I don't mean it to be like judgmental or anything, because it's like, just like he talks about later in the, you know, around the precepts, everything is complex. It's not that simple. It's not just like, well, you shouldn't ever take a vacation. You know, it's just, it's a question. I feel like these ideals are, they're meant to keep us on our toes. They're meant to keep us from getting complacent and just going like, everything's fine. It's just like, but what about that? But what about that? So that we always question, like, I'm getting an accordion and I'm going to learn how to play the accordion. And I'm excusing it because I want to use it in my activism and to go along with activist songs. But that, you know, it's going to be above and beyond that. So that, to me, it's like, this is, okay, so how is this benefiting other beings? But you know, it's true at that deep level, when we honestly look at our lives, it's like, what is the result? Is the result that I tap into a part of myself that's been neglected for a long time, and I'm actually a richer, calmer, more resourceful person for other people, perhaps? So I think, you know, it's not simple. All right, well, 9 o'clock, thank you. I hope it was engaging. Do our closing. We offer the merit of our Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you, Domio.
Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Good night.
I look forward to recording your Dharma talks in the future.
And I hope you come back and see us.
I think I will. Thank you so much.
Get out of here. Domio, music's never a bad idea. You never know what you'll get out of people when you communicate that way.
And it's a way to tap into people's emotions, I realized. Like, well, I start to sing these activist songs, it's like, I connect with it in a much different way than just a speech or just, you know, learning some facts. It's like, dang, it's making me think, like, I think we need some Zen songs.
Yeah. That's what the chants are, sort of.
They don't tap into the same thing at all. No. There was a song when I went to I did a talk at the McMinnville, is it the Unitarian Church? And they had a Buddhist song. They had a song about, like, the Buddha's, like, what was it? Do you know which one it is? It was like about the Four Noble Truths or something like that. And it was like, it made me tear up. It was really pretty.
Oh, that's cool.
Did they use an accordion?
Huh?
Was it accompanied by an accordion?
No, not at all. I've always just wanted to play the accordion. I used to play the piano and I like the idea of an instrument I can walk around with.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's a good protest instrument, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah. It'll get their attention.
Guitar is more typical, but I tried that. That's too hard.
I don't know, man. Accordion's kind of hard. So from what I hear, I don't play it, but
we'll see. The fingers.
It's this whole squeezing and moving and fingering at the same time.
I know that would be very hard for me doing two things. Yeah.
I think the playing the piano part really helps.
Yeah.
All
right. Well, have a good evening.
Good time, everybody.
Nice to meet you, Shane.
Nice meeting you too. Take care.